choke, let you choke.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. At their meeting last week, considering options for fencing around the baseball diamond in City Park turned into a passionate debate, with community members coming before council to discuss safety, community use, and heritage. Kingston proposed the cricket field at City Park for the 2024 Little League Canada Championship. Planning began in 2022 with community support but concerns over changes to the park, particularly regarding fencing for the new baseball diamond. A heritage permit and community consultation was required to install temporary outfield fencing for the tournament. As the event came and went, community feedback favored keeping the fence. Last September, council directed staff to consult with local associations to explore options for a permanent outfield fence, delaying the removal of the temporary fence until early 2025. Council was given five options to consider at their meeting last week, including permanent and temporary fencing options, with the fifth option notably being a late addition made at the meeting to leave the fencing as is and do nothing. The Sydenham District Association, a group of approximately 250 community members in the neighborhood, was consulted by the city when looking at options. The SDA's preference was temporary fencing to preserve multi-use open space, with concerns that fencing divides the park and limits the use of the overall space. Melissa Cox and Tori Beauchart with the Kingston Baseball Association spoke before council in favor of keeping fencing.
By removing the fence and creating gaps in the fence, it seems that a higher value is placed on the aesthetics of the field over safety and protection. The first and most pressing reason retaining the outfield fence should be safety. The fence also serves to protect the baseball field. At the centerpiece of many games and events, the integrity of the pitch is vital for ensuring consistent play. The fence not only saves us from resources and maintenance, but also helps preserve the quality of the field for future matches. We agree with the SDA that City Park is a special place that is used for more than just tournaments and baseball games. With all the green space that City Park and Cricket Field share, this is more than enough room for all the various groups to continue their use. The fence keeps these various groups safe with the sport is being played. We recognize the points forth by SDA regarding aesthetics and the potential impact of visual appeal of the area. However, we challenge you to see the fence not as a blight of landscape, but as an integral part of feature that defines the space for the better. The aesthetics of the area must be balanced with the practical needs of the community. The fence does not detract from the beauty of the park, but instead create a purposeful, organized space where people can enjoy both the sport and the surrounding nature safely.
Well, speaking to the national level tournaments, a fence is a must. We just wouldn't get those tournaments if we didn't have it. But on a local scale, I think every kid dreams of hitting a home run over the fence. And really at that age, there's not very many parks that have an outfield fence that they can do that. So I think that's probably one of the biggest exciting draws as a kid. The downfall to not having a fence is you have kids like Doug McKay's son who hits the ball really, really far. And then you have kids chasing the ball through potholes and things that are beyond and into the sloped area. Back before the renovation of the field, we've adjusted the direction of the field, but back before there was kids regularly running uphill to catch a ball and running out onto the road to catch those balls. So I think that's the biggest drawback to not having the outfield fence.
Community member Doug McKay also explained more of the significance of the fencing for those who use the diamond.
You know, I think we're lucky to live in a city that supports proper facilities. I hate to see them dismembered, but the fence is inherently part of the field. If you listen to kids, they talk about hitting it over the fence, running one against the fence. In the baseball world, the pitchers see the fence as their enemy. It's a special place for the kids. It draws them in. So, you know, it's like when your kids get to play at Slush Puppy Place, they feel like they're part of something. So, you know, I think it's okay to have a proper diamond as a proper diamond. We've got great facilities with regard to other sports. It's one that we've never had. Kind of keeping it as is, it's good sense to me.
After hearing from other community members, SDA spokesperson Martha Vosper spoke before council, expressing disappointment in how the discussion had gone when the SDA was under the impression that the original pitch was temporary fencing for the 2024 Little League Canada Championship.
I question the need to have belabored this whole thing. We had an agreement in place before construction occurred. This feels very much like bad faith. It's an incredible amount of time and energy on the part of volunteers and the city staff. So it makes me very sad. Quality of life is also about trust. It's about modeling cooperation, teamwork, and honoring agreements. Quality of life is about choices. We are living in a time that has caused us to be on the opposite side of the fence on many topics. What do we really choose to do as human beings, as community members? Having a difference of opinion is not failure. Competition to be right is not success. Build fences or build strong communities.
In the end, councillors voted 9-4 for option 5, to do nothing and leave the current fencing, meaning the existing home run fence will remain a permanent fixture in the park. Notably, options ranged between costs of $50,000 to $220,000, with additional costs per event for temporary fencing, except the option to do nothing, which included no additional costs. Councillors Don Amos, Wendy Steven, and Brandon Tozo gave their reasons for supporting option 5.
If you don't have an outfield fence and that ball comes screaming at you, it's going to hurt. The fence is needed for that safety protection. Hitting a home run as a 10, 12, 13-year-old does not happen very often. But when it does happen, what a joyous experience for that child. Sometimes you have to define the field of play. It is also creating an opportunity for us to host national tournaments. $1.2, $1.3 million is a tough thing to walk away from when you want to host something. Ask our downtown shop owners. Our accommodation partners are not selling out in the summer.
Let's move on from this and let's celebrate that children are outside playing sports, that their parents are so engaged with either playing with their kids or watching the game that they are living in the moment and not scrolling on their phones or thinking about their phones. That our community gets to learn how to handle the highs and lows of winning and losing with grace and dignity, because we can see in our world right now what happens when people don't know how to lose well. This field is a remarkable part of our community. Let's leave the fence where it is, support option 5, and let's let the kids play. Thanks.
I think we've spent a lot of time in a previous council and in this council debating this issue. Council has a lot of really important issues to talk about. I'm fine with option 5. I think it's working. We're seeing a growing need for our community, especially with baseball, with young kids playing. It's a great addition, I think, to City Park. I recognize that there is some frustration from the surrounding community there, that council may have altered its consideration, but I just echo Councillor Steven said, we don't have to stand by a bad decision. I think there's also a philosophical difference that's happening here, is that Kingston is growing and changing. And as it's growing and changing, we have to grow and change as well as with our political leadership. We have to be willing to change the way that we've done things and make changes to our community. And we have to lead the community along the way as we do so. I'm happy to support this option. I think we need to put this to rest and we need to get off the fence and make a decision. Thank you.
However, Councillor Connie Glenn went to bat for the SDA, concerned about the late addition of option 5 and the original impression of the fence as temporary.
I think the sad part about this for me is that although we're focusing on, you know, the opportunity for youth to play baseball, We're doing so at the expense of, I think, the goodwill that did exist here in the community for both the sport and the use of the park by the people in the neighborhood. What we're talking about isn't just people feeling bad because an agreement was broken. There was a lot of time put into this, and they're not against baseball. It's being spun as though they're not happy and excited about the diamond. They are. They had a great time. They were enjoying it. They welcomed it until we turned around and decided we were going to put this out on the table again. Now, the other options, there's at least some wiggle here. There's at least some recognition that their voices were part of this conversation. This option is just saying, hey, we consulted with you, but yeah, no biggie, right? We might as well not have gone through this consultation. And in fact, I think it would have been better if we hadn't. We wasted a lot of time. We wasted a lot of energy.
Mayor Brian Patterson closed out the passionate discussion.
Just because council doesn't make a decision in line with what you want does not mean that your voice wasn't heard. That's a really important point to make, because inevitably around this table, we have to balance different interests from the community. And so I can assure you on this issue and on every other issue that we deal with around this table, regardless of how the vote goes, your voice is heard. Right? Every single one of us around this table, we consider all sides of all the issues. At the end of the day, it comes down to a vote, what you think is the best thing for the community as a whole. It's important that every single one of us, regardless of what district we represent, we make decisions based on what is best for the city as a whole. And so I believe that that's exactly the intention and the heart of everyone around this table. So I think it's important to make that point. At the end of the day, everybody's voice is heard. In this case, I don't think that it is possible to come up with an option that will satisfy everybody.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, folks. This is Abias from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. This week, we have Shaping Your Career Purpose workshop organized by Queen's Career Services. This will help students explore meaningful career paths aligned with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. The workshop takes place on March 5th from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. at Gordon Hall, Room 202. We have Mr. Miguel from Queen's Career Services in studio today to tell us more about this workshop. Hello, Mr. Miguel. We are delighted to have you in studio. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for asking. Can you give our audience an overview of this workshop and what can participants expect from this workshop?
So in this workshop, it's a career exploration workshop. So we're going to carve out very precious time for people to think about their future, which a lot of us don't have time to do when we're busy dealing with assignments and things that are due today or yesterday. So we're going to have a little bit of space to think about what do we want to do in the future, maybe after graduation. And we start by going over a few key ideas and theories about how to face uncertainty with a sense of hope, and about learning to adopt a design thinking mindset in life planning. That's the foundation that we work from. And then we will look backwards and inwards, thinking about who each person is, you know, what experiences have you had and what you've learned about yourself that will inform the future decisions. And then we look forwards, looking at possibilities. And we start, you know, very broad and abstract, and we get more and more focused and concrete throughout the whole workshop. And in the end, we kind of arrive at some next steps of where a person can go to move forward and exploring the career possibilities.
That sounds amazing. I'm a Queen student, and I can say that sometimes I'm very confused about choosing my future career path. Jumping to the sustainability aspect of the whole workshop, why is it important for students to align their careers with the UN Sustainable Development Goals?
I think it's a very powerful reframe. So a lot of the time when I talk to people about careers, they tend to have a limited focus of what's possible. They think about what are the most common degrees options. If you're studying politics, you might think everyone becomes a lawyer, or people often focus just on what their parents do, and they only think they have a few possibilities. But the SDGs switch our way of thinking and get us to think more broadly, using a bit of a challenge mindset, thinking about what does the world need, what's important, what opportunities are there, what aligns with my values. And that framework, like, it's a vetted, internationally developed framework, the SDG framework, that many, many countries have all agreed to. But the problem with that framework is it's a bit abstract. So if you look at it and it says no poverty or clean energy, it's hard for you to go outside today and go do no poverty. But that's where the workshop and the website that we've made, the UN SDG Career Guide, are meant to take us from abstract ideas into concrete possibilities and actions. And so through both the website and the workshop, we have people look at possible job titles, possible next steps, possible ways to get involved. And all of this gets us thinking, instead of about problems or fears, about positive psychology related powerful concepts, like what your values are, what your strengths are. And we tend to be more intrinsically motivated when we're connected to something that is larger than ourselves, with a bit of a sense of purpose or meaning. It can usually lead to better mental health, as well as success. We tend to do better when we care about something. We probably try harder, are more curious, we'll take risks talking to people about it, and usually be more successful if we're invested in something.
That sounds wonderful, actually. So how can students apply what they learn in this session and make real impacts in their careers?
The whole thing is meant to be very applicable to real life. It's all about thinking about what's next and what do they want, not about me or anyone else telling them what they should be doing. So to get a sense of direction for themselves and self-authorship. And so we zoom out, get them to think about the big picture, and then slowly move forward into next steps and possibilities. So they should come out of it with concrete next steps that they can do. It couldn't be more practical in terms of where do they go from the workshop.
Right. So speaking of that, can you share some practical tools or strategies that students will take away from this workshop?
Sure. Yeah, beyond the ideas at the beginning that people have said are quite powerful and help them feel hopeful in terms of facing the world and taking action on it, there's a couple of strategies / tools that we use in it. One, we do mind mapping as a way of thinking about a complex subject. And we'll do that, and they get to take that home with them, and they can use that technique in other places. And the other one is an idea of prototyping that comes from design thinking as well, where they'll be developing a few different prototypes, multiple prototypes, related to future possibilities, not just one, to open up the thinking and get them reacting to something more concrete. And then the last tool would just be the SDG Career Guide website that we'll be working with people during the workshop, but they can obviously go and look at that before and after as well.
Great. So the last question for the segment, how can students sign up for the workshop, and is there any deadline to register?
Yeah, so it's pretty easy to go to our website, careers.queensu.ca for career services. Go there and they log into our portal, My Career. And then underneath events and workshops, there's a calendar. They click on it, register. The workshop is on Wednesday, March 5th, 12 till 2 p.m., and it's in Gordon Hall, room 302. And you can register right up until the workshop starts. If you hear this interview on Monday and you think about it on Tuesday, you can still register. And also on that calendar of events, I want to point out one other related thing. If you're interested in this workshop on Work with Impact, we have a panel that is happening on March 26th, the Work with Impact Alumni Panel and Reception. It's celebrating the launch of the website. There's going to be a bunch of interesting alumni there. The principal is going to say some things as well for closing remarks, but it's going to be thinking about social impact, career possibilities, and hearing from alumni and their inspiring journeys.
That sounds great. Thank you, Mr. Miguel, for joining us in studio today and sharing your insightful views on career paths in general and the upcoming workshop. I wish you all the best, and I hope you have a really impactful session.
Thank you. Pleasure meeting with you.
Same. And that's a wrap. Folks, we were in conversation with Mr. Miguel from Queen's Career Services, and they're organizing a workshop on shaping careers with purpose and alignment with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. Stay tuned for more updates. Over to Isabella for sports after.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, March 5th, 7 degrees with periods of rain throughout the day, and dependent on the forecast, some are predicting the possibility of an afternoon thunder shower on Wednesday, March 5th, dropping down to zero overnight. Thursday, March 6th, we're going to see a daytime high of 1 degree with a 60% chance of flurries or rain showers, dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Friday, March 7th, daytime high of 1 degree with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to minus 6 overnight. Moving into the weekend now, Saturday, March 8th, daytime high of minus 1 with a mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, March 9th, going to be slightly warmer, just above 0 with a daytime high of 1 in that mix of sun and cloud. And then Monday, March 10th, we're going to see a daytime high of 4 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, March 3rd, 2025. Reduced load restrictions are in effect in Kingston as of March 1st. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. The ban on overnight street parking in Kingston will remain in effect due to extended snow cleanup and forecasted winter weather. The ban will be in effect until Friday, March 7th, at which time the city will reevaluate snow removal operations and weather conditions. While the ban is in place, parking on all city streets is prohibited between the hours of 1 a.m. and 7 a.m. and from 12 a.m. to 7 a.m. on the streets that surround Kingston General Hospital. Vehicles parked on the street overnight during a ban are subject to being ticketed or towed. The ban will remain in place until the city deems it no longer necessary. When the ban is revoked, notice will be posted on the City of Kingston website. Here are some relevant road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. And Albert Street, Princess 2 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Other delays, Front Road Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. And Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue.
Hello, I'm Henry Walker, CFRC intern from the Queen's Department of History. Here's today's concert and events calendar. Starting with concerts, on Wednesday, the Vancouver Chamber Choir will be performing at the Isabel from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Tickets for this performance are available online between $15 and $45. Also on Wednesday, the country group Whiskey Smoke will be playing at the Buckle starting at 7:30. Folks can also head over to Hotel Wolf Island, which is hosting its weekly open mic starting at 8:30. On Thursday, Trailer Swift Band will be playing at the Buckle from 8 to 11. The John McLern Band will also be playing, this time at the club at the RCHA from 7 to 11. And earlier in the evening, the group Clear Breeze will be playing at Hotel Wolf Island from 6 to 9 p.m. Also on Thursday, both Susan Natal and Matt McKenzie will be performing at Musiki from 8 to 11 p.m. On Friday, the International Women's Day Showcase, an event co-hosted by Miss Emily with support from CFRC Music, is being held at the Broom Factory from 7 to 10 p.m. The event, with tickets costing around $20, will feature performances from Savannah Shea, Julia Finnegan, Kira Daniel, and Clara Smallman. The spectators will be playing at the RCHA from 8 onwards. There was a $5 door charge. Folks can also head over to Hotel Wolf Island to catch Shuffle Demons, who will be playing from 8:30 to 10:30. Tickets are costing around $46.24. Also on Friday, Gerald McGrath will be playing at 9 p.m. at Tiernanog, and the Royal Tavern will be having Simon Webb performing from 7 to 5, and later band Sweet Pete and the Heat from 9 p.m. onwards. Next up on Saturday, band Cadillac Rumble is playing at the Buckle from 9 to 12:30 p.m. Also, Brass Over Tea Kettle will be playing at Daft Brewing 8 p.m. onwards, kicking off the weekend before March break. $46.50 will get folks into the Spire on Saturday to see Outskirts, Eric Urin, Megan Ball, who will kick off stuff at 8 p.m. Also on Saturday, No Limits will be playing some classic rock covers at Tiernanog at 9. And on Sunday, the folk singer-songwriter duo Bad Fortune will be performing from 2 to 5 p.m. at Daft Brewing. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Hello again, this is Henry Walker bringing you this week's events calendar. On Wednesday, folks can head down to Musiki, which is hosting its weekly life drawing event. Don't forget to bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing. One Eye Jats will be hosting board game night starting at 7. Also on Wednesday, the Grad Club will be hosting the open stage drag show starting at 8 p.m. Those interested in performing should arrive before 7:45 or during intermission around 9 p.m. Performance slots are first come, first serve. Also on Wednesday, Daft Brewing and Something in the Water will host their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group has a public run starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. On Friday, the Buckle and Daft Brewing will host their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. On Saturday, the Kingston Public Market runs at Springer Market Square starting at 8:30 a.m. On Sunday morning, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. Fraggle Rock Live, presented by the Jim Henson Company, is being held at the Grand Theater at 3:30. Tickets are available for around $29 to $39. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
CFRC from Kingston, Ontario. Your volunteer program, Campus and Community Radio at 101.9 FM and on the web at cfrc.ca.
Hey CFRC listeners, in celebration of International Women's Day, local icon Miss Emily and the Kingston Music Office are hosting an International Women's Day showcase on March 7th at the Broom Factory with support from your friends here at CFRC. Experience a showcase celebrating the remarkable talents of women and non-binary artists in the Kingston community. Miss Emily will be hosting the night with feature performances from Clara Smallman, Julia Finnegan, Kyra Daniel, and Savannah Shea. Stay for the fireside chat exploring songwriting, creativity, and the challenges of navigating the music industry as underrepresented voices, as well as a showcase of women-led businesses in the Kingston community. It's sure to be the event of the season. Doors are at 7 p.m. and tickets can be found at ticketscene.ca.
This CDG month, discover how Queen's alumni are driving meaningful change through impactful careers aligned with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. On Wednesday, March 26, Queen's students are invited to join Queen's Career Services and the Principal's Office for the Work with Impact alumni panel discussion. You will hear inspiring stories, gain insights into professional journeys, and learn practical strategies for creating social impact and inspiring hope through your own career. Register to attend through My Career or through Queen's CDG Month Canada calendar.
Even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times, I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now. I want to be living proof to younger trans people that like you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Two young men in Indonesia to be flogged for gay sex. A UK appeals court nixes a non-binary gender marker. And building a joyful transmasculine community. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With NewsWrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Two young men in the Indonesian province of Aceh are to be publicly beaten with a cane for having gay sex. They were arrested on November 7th after anti-queer vigilantes broke into their rented room and discovered them naked and hugging each other. Under Islamic law, they were tried for morality offenses. The 18 and 24-year-old college students were sentenced to 80 and 85 lashes, respectively. Sakwana is the single name of the judge overseeing the trial. That's a custom for many Indonesians. Her ruling found, during the trial, it was proven that the defendants committed illicit acts, including kissing and having sex. While the maximum penalty is 100 lashings in public and up to 8 years in prison, Sakwana lessened the sentences because neither had a police record, both were polite in court, and they are otherwise considered to be outstanding students. The older of the two will be flogged the most. The pair accepted their sentences without appeal. Sharia has been the law in Aceh province since a 2006 dispute with federal authorities allowed it to adopt Islamic legal practice. The rest of Indonesia is governed by secular laws. More than 100 people each year in the province have been publicly caned for various morality offenses. The scheduled public caning in Aceh comes on the heels of last week's raid on what authorities called a gay sex party in Jakarta. 56 men were arrested in a private hotel room and charged with violating the country's secular laws against obscenity and pornography.
British law does not recognize non-binary as a gender, according to the United Kingdom Court of Appeal. Cybersecurity expert Ryan Castellucci moved from Los Angeles in 2019. They obtained legal recognition as non-binary in California in 2021 and were issued a U.S. passport listing their gender as X the following year. They tried to have their gender recorded as non-binary on a U.K. gender recognition certificate, a document which changes someone's legal sex. They lost the bid in an earlier high court challenge. Meanwhile, a Trump administration executive order has eliminated the X-gender passport option. Lord Justice Singh deferred to Parliament in dismissing the appeal, saying that the UK's two-gender policy was up to lawmakers to address, not the judiciary. Castellucci called their efforts to be legally recognized as non-binary an ordeal, but their lawyers say they are considering a further appeal. At 30-something, they're looking ahead saying, I plan to live the rest of my life here and eventually die here. Being denied the dignity of knowing my death certificate will be correct makes my stomach turn.
Iowa's transgender people are no longer protected from discrimination. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a bill that revokes the addition of gender identity to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. Thus, The current Republican-dominated state legislature has undone the statute by the previous Democratic administration and affirmed by the state Supreme Court in 2022. Hundreds of people rallied at the state Capitol building to protest the bill's imminent passage.
We are trans like we're together, and we are singing for our lives.
Iowa's legislature ignored the voices of the people. The Republicans argued that revoking gender identity protections in civil rights laws will make it easier for the state to defend its other anti-trans laws, such as the ban on trans student competitors in female sports. That's already being challenged in court. Iowa is now the first state in U.S. history to excise a class originally granted civil rights protection. Max Mowitz of queer advocacy group One Iowa told the Des Moines Register, "This law will cause real harm, making daily life harder and more uncertain for countless Iowans who simply want to live openly and authentically. History will not look kindly on this moment."
Two executive orders by U.S. President Donald Trump that threaten the civil rights of LGBTQ people and other U.S. citizens are already being roadblocked in court. Maryland-based U.S. District Judge Adam B. Abelson said that the key provisions targeting federal agencies and federal-funded diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in higher education and the private sector were impermissibly vague and threatened to chill constitutionally protected speech and activity. Abelson issued a preliminary injunction this week blocking their enforcement. The ruling noted that the administration's effort to uproot DEI programs failed to define key terms, such as equity-related and illegal DEI. Abelson was not convinced that the order was necessary to root out illegal discrimination. This challenge is being led by national education groups and the city of Baltimore. At least one other lawsuit against the anti-diversity order has been filed by Lambda Legal and the Legal Defense Fund on behalf of the National Urban League, the National Fair Housing Alliance, and AIDS Foundation Chicago.
The block on a second Trump order is keeping transgender women in U.S. women's prisons from being transferred to men's prisons. That action was to comply with the Trump decree that U.S. law recognizes only two genders, male and female. Washington, D.C.-based U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth ruled that the move would violate trans women's constitutional rights and put them in jeopardy of serious harm. Lamberth had previously issued an order to protect three trans women inmates from imminent transfer. The latest ruling expands that protection to nine additional plaintiffs who were rounded up by Bureau of Prison officials and told they would be immediately transferred to men's prisons, according to court filings. The Trump order also terminates current gender-affirming health care for trans inmates. The judge believes the lawsuit challenging the Trump anti-trans order is likely to be overturned on Eighth Amendment protections against imposing excessive bail, excessive fines, or cruel and unusual punishments. Judge Lamberth questioned the Trump administration's motives. He wrote that the order would exacerbate the symptoms of their gender dysphoria, even if they are not subject to physical or sexual violence in their new facility, whether because they will be subject to searches by male correctional officers, made to shower in the company of men, referred to as men.
The U.S. Supreme Court is letting Tennessee's virtual ban on drag performances stand. On February 24th, it decided not to hear a case challenging the law. The legislation was enacted by the Republican-controlled state in 2023. It was ruled unconstitutionally vague and substantially overbroad by a judge on the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Tennessee. However, last July, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the decision on a technicality. The top court has now let stand its finding that the complainant, Friends of George Incorporated Drag Theater Company of Memphis, lacked the legal standing to sue.
another lawsuit challenging Tennessee's drag ban, is still working its way through the U.S. judicial system. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit on behalf of Blount County Pride organizers because the law threatened prosecution of any violators during its 2023 Pride Festival.
Finally, however, there was one hearing the U.S. High Court did hold this week. The reverse discrimination case of a straight, white, cisgender woman who claims that she was denied a promotion and demoted after allegedly less qualified queer colleagues gained positions ahead of her. 60-year-old Marlene Ames worked for years for the Ohio Department of Youth Services, the state's juvenile justice system. A lower appeals court ruled in her case that a so-called majority group plaintiff must meet a higher evidentiary standard than plaintiffs in other bias cases. In other words, it's harder for heterosexual workers to prove discrimination based on sexual orientation or for white employees claiming racial bias. The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling before the current term ends in late June. A number of civil rights groups are deeply concerned that a win for Ames could open a Pandora's box of countless reverse discrimination cases, and that could be especially dangerous in the current climate against diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Shazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
There's a giant eraser moving across the USA, and the letters T and Q are disappearing from the government's LGBTQ-related websites and publications. The Trump administration has even wiped any mention of transgender people from the signage outside the Stonewall National Monument, despite the fact that it was trans activists who launched the 1969 rebellion it memorializes. While conservative politicians are using their network of far-right media outlets to power the transphobic purge, This Way Out's David Hunt met one New York college student who's focused on a new kind of narrative, the history and the joy of transmasculine community building.
In an open letter to the academic community in the summer of 2009, scholar Eve Tuck urged educators to reconsider the impact of what she called damage-centered research, work that focuses on people's pain and brokenness to hold those in power accountable for their oppression. It may be well-intentioned, she wrote, but this type of research reinforces and reinscribes a one-dimensional notion of people as depleted, ruined, and hopeless. Instead, she said, academics should seek to understand the complexity, contradiction, and self-determination of the people they study. Focus on their desires, not their damage, she said. As Tuck wrote those words, seated at a little table in her Hudson Valley, New York home, a young tomboy in rural Pennsylvania looked up at the night sky, caught a glimpse of a shooting star, and made a wish. I hope I wake up
tomorrow and I'm a boy.
I'm David Hunt. Eli Butler's wish did come true, eventually. The Pennsylvania tomboy is now a 22-year-old transgender man, living in New York City, and conducting academic research of his own. Research centered on the joy of being transmasculine. Research influenced by the scholarship of Eve Tuck, and inspired by the transmasculine activists who paved his way. I no longer want damage to be the focus of research about trans communities, Butler said in his senior thesis for a degree in peace and justice studies. I want to shift the research narrative toward possibility. I sat down with Butler to discuss his life, his research, and the possibilities of the future.
I love being trans. Like, I've enjoyed this journey. I think that life is like, and for everybody is just kind of learning more about yourself every day and like making changes in your life that accompany that. So I'm like still figuring out who I am as a trans person every day.
That's not to say the Pace University undergraduate's life is free from oppression. On the day we talked, the National Park Service was busy rewriting history, erasing the story of the transgender activists who led the 1969 protests at the Stonewall Inn, what is now the Stonewall National Monument, less than 2 miles from the Pace University campus in New York. But the Trump administration's efforts to legally extinguish the visibility, even the very existence, of transgender people has galvanized the community. More than 1,000 protesters rallied at the historic site on February 14th to decry the Park Service's erasure of trans history. It seemed fitting that this demonstration of loud and proud queer community should happen while Butler and I discussed the focus of his senior thesis, community building by transmasculine people, past and present. In researching his thesis at the New York Public Library and in archives of transgender publications and organizations, Butler discovered that transmasculine community building has a rich and layered history going back generations.
I think that, like, a lot of times we think that trans people were all underground until the 2000s or until the late 90s. But that was not the case. And reading these newsletters was like, wow, they've been telling us that we haven't existed until now. Like, we have existed and been loud about it for decades now.
The literature review section of Butler's thesis is a history lesson, chronicling the contributions of trans men who are largely unknown and unappreciated today, including Steve Dane, who made headlines in the late 1970s after transitioning and being fired from his job as a public high school teacher, and Mario Martino, who established a counseling service for trans men called Labyrinth in 1968.
It was really heartwarming to me to see the ways that different trans guys talked about themselves and talked about the other trans guys that they were with, how similar it was to experiences that I've had and other people had. I just think there's so many similarities, even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times. I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now.
To learn more about community building by trans masculine men today, Butler interviewed 3 trans men, a licensed therapist in a southern state who facilitates a virtual trans masculine support group, the leader of the Louisville Trans Masculine Alliance in Kentucky, and a counselor for the Virginia Tech chapter of Delta Lambda Phi, a fraternity for gay, bisexual, transgender, and progressive men. Among Butler's findings, masculinity can be problematic.
I see a lot of stuff online from people who are like, you're going to the dark side, like when you're transitioning into a masculine identity. And so I think a lot of masculine people like feel discouraged by that. And they want to be around people who also see masculinity more in a more positive light.
Butler found that community building evolved as a survival tactic to create spaces of support and understanding among an astoundingly underrepresented and isolated group. And he demonstrated that community building is affected by differences in geography and organizing styles.
I mean, there are similarities between all of the groups for sure, but you know, based on the different focuses of these groups, you're having different community building experiences. So like one of these was this like trans masculine frat. And so, you know, building community in a frat is so much different than building community in a support group. Like you're talking about different things, you're focusing on different things, but there is like this general relation between everybody. Even these groups that are so different in how they go about building community, they are talking about and focusing on similar things. They're just going about it in different ways.
A nearly universal advantage of community building, Butler found, is its role in healing trauma. Trauma isolates. The group recreates a sense of belonging, Butler explained, referencing the work of American psychiatrist Judith Lewis Herman.
I read a lot of books from therapists and psychiatrists about how building community heals trauma, which I think is especially important in the trans community, which even if you're a trans person that hasn't experienced any kind of personal transphobia, you know, you're living in this society which is just violently transphobic. So building community like allows you to heal those wounds in a certain way. You're now in a place where people understand you. They understand your trauma. Maybe they've been through similar things, or in the broader way, they understand exactly the feelings that you're feeling. And you can process that trauma together. And that is the healing power of community.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Eli Butler about his research into transmasculine community building. Butler's academic work is informed by his personal journey as a transgender man. That journey began at an early age.
I actually realized I was trans when I was in the fourth grade. I think I was around 8 years old. I changed my name. I went through like kind of a social transition, which is kind of the most that a lot of younger kids can do. I wore, you know, more masculine clothing. I went by a different name. I went by different pronouns. That was so against the status quo. Not that like being trans isn't against the status quo already, but you know, for someone so young. And so I was kind of like, I want to say forced out of that, or like kind of pressure was put on me to grow out of that. And so I went back to living as a woman and identifying as a woman until around COVID. And COVID was really the time when I had time to sit with myself. And I feel like this happened to a lot of people. It was like the first time you were forced to be alone with your thoughts and really like reflect on how you see yourself, how you see the world. And that's when I realized that I was non-binary. And then when I finally came to college, I realized that I was more binary masculine than I thought I was at first.
But even in New York, a metropolis with one of the world's largest LGBTQ populations, Butler discovered that something was missing in his life.
I mean, I think of New York in terms of like the gay revolution of the 70s, expecting it to be like full of activities and clubs and groups of people that just like were so like out and proud about their queerness or their transness. And I came to New York and to a liberal arts college thinking that's how it would be. I would find my people who understood me and it would just be so easy. And It was not. And I actually found a lack of transmasculine, specifically groups in New York City.
It was that experience, the longing for community, that led Butler to focus his senior thesis on transmasculine community building. In doing that, he discovered the challenges, as well as the joys, of creating change.
One of my interviewees said something that really struck me, and this is how I think of how strengthening community needs to be now, which is that community is a two-way street. You're not just coming to the community or trying to find a community when you need help. You're there all the time. You're there to support people when they need help, and then so that when you need help, you can come to them.
Now that his senior thesis is done, Butler has the time to focus on some community building of his own. He's spearheading a project to create a quilt of trans joy, a project inspired by the Norfolk Trans Joy Community Quilt, a project led by partners Bo Brannick and Alice Bigsby Bye in the United Kingdom.
I am holding workshops where trans people, trans students can come in and, you know, their allies, their loved ones or their friends can come in, make a quilt square. Then it's going to be this big quilt of like trans joy. And it's going to be put up in the LGBTQ center at the school and whatnot. So it's like, it's half this like community building and art focused kind of project. And it's also half like a political resistance kind of message.
At the end of the day, Butler explained, building community is about finding your people and finding your joy.
I can't imagine being a young trans person right now, looking at the news and being like, wow, like my identity is all based in suffering, because that's a lot of times what it seems like. I've had younger trans people like in my life say this to me, where they're like, you seem like you like being trans, like, can you tell me that it gets better? I like want to be living proof to younger trans people that like you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
I'd like to thank Eli Butler for sharing his story for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Joe Bainline and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. Seals and Croft, T. Ricky, J. Patrick Lemieux, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard. And Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Hal Myers of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, WCRX, Chicago, Illinois, CJLY, Nelson Crawford Bay, New Denver, British Columbia, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Wolf Island in Kingston, massive. Saturday, April 5th, Canada's Reggae Ambassadors, the Human Rights, invites you to join us as we celebrate the release of our new album, One People, at the Hotel Wolf Island. Tickets are $25 advance at thehotelwolfisland.com, $30 at the door. Show starts at 7:30, and we'll be playing two full sets. Check out thehumanrights.ca for more info. That's the Human Rights, One People album release party, Saturday, April 5th, at the Hotel